From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me.
Journalist and educator Jim Newton is my guest. He's the author of several books, including Justice for All, Earl Warren and the Nation He Made, Eisenhower, The White House Years, and Man of Tomorrow, The Restless Life of Jerry Brown. His latest book is called Here Beside the Rising Tide, Jerry Garcia, The Grateful Dead, and An American Awakening. Jim Newton, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, I think listeners need to know right away that this book is a fantastic history book, and I don't think it's necessarily a book for deadheads, although I'm sure they'll enjoy it. And I'll probably tell you all kinds of things you got wrong.
But correct.
They didn't have that speaker in 1973.
This is true enough.
It's a layered and deep diving look to the roots of the counterculture in America in the 60s and 70s. And what made you turn to this subject now? Is it the Ship of Fools currently in view?
Well, that certainly is a coincidence of timing, if nothing else. That's actually not what drew me to the book. I was actually writing the book in the first Trump administration, thinking that we were done with all of that by the time I was finished. And, of course, here we are again, which is another conversation maybe for another day. But, no, I thought about doing this book for a very long time, in fact, and put it off a couple of times. Most recently, I was thinking about doing it in, 2015, 2016, something like that. And then Jerry Brown agreed to a series of interviews. And so I decided, while he was still governor, I decided to focus on that first. And I saw the Brown book as kind of a companion book to the Earl Warren book, The Great Governors of California. So I put this off one more time. And then when I was done with the Brown book, decided it was time to turn to it. And the Brown book helped me to write this book, actually, in the sense that it covers some of the same period, years. It's all in California. So in some ways, the two stories I think of as kind of companion pieces in a different way than the Warren book, in that with Brown and Garcia, you sort of have the Brown book kind of puts the politics of that period in the front and the culture in the back. And the Garcia book is the fronts with the culture, with the politics behind it. So they're kind of mirror images of each other in a certain way.
And I guess they both had comebacks. And Jerry
Brown. Yeah. Well, and they're both Jerry's from San Francisco. So, you know, it all seems very small in one sense.
That's right. Jerry Brown dated Linda Ronstadt for a while.
He sure
did. Yeah. Definitely involved in the music industry for sure.
Yeah.
Then I don't think there was ever a Jerry Brown day on the green, but who knows?
not yet.
That's right. Not yet. He's not done. So you've written about politics. And so what degree do you see Jerry Garcia as a political figure?
Not as a political figure in a conventional sense. And certainly he did not think of himself as a political figure. I think if you broaden the lens of what we think of as politics, there's a way to think of him as a political figure. He lived a life of values. He felt strongly about those values. They were often in opposition to what we would think of as sort of mainstream values. And so I think if we think of politics as the expression of and the advocacy and the propoundment of values, then I think it's in those terms you can think of Garcia as a political figure. But he didn't endorse candidates. He didn't raise money for candidates or for elections. So in that kind of narrower conception of politics, he'd be outside of politics as we would describe it that way.
But the nature of the Grateful Dead and of Jerry Garcia, it's sort of a life as a political figure in a way, right? And politics is art, you know?
Unquestionably, yes. And the art, even if it is not explicitly political, it has a kind of political valence, I would say. And it's also worth noting, if you look at the benefits that the Grateful Dead did over the years, they are uniformly left liberal, right? I mean, there's no Grateful Dead benefit for the National Rifle Association, you know. So I don't think there's any question but that their personal politics were liberal, and the Garcias were as well. It's just that he saw the music as a different kind of expression than, as I say, a kind of a candidate-based or election-based kind of political expression.
Well, I mean, they certainly don't alienate any faction of Americans' political beliefs. I mean, there's lots of Republican fans of the Grateful Dead, right?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I do think the implicit politics of the Grateful Dead and of Garcia are unaccommodating of right-wing politics. But the music allows space for that. And yes, there are conservatives who consider themselves deadheads, or at least fans of the band, certainly.
Yeah. What about you? Well, I mean, I know you're not a Republican, but were you a deadhead? Did you follow the Dead? Did you see them in concert many times and so on?
Yeah. You know, I don't presume to call myself a deadhead. I've met a lot of people, certainly in the course of this book, who've been to a lot more shows than I ever even thought of going to. But, you know, I went to Palo Alto High School. So I was in Palo Alto for my sort of formative young years. The music was very much around there. I've taken in 40 or 50 shows probably over the years. So I consider myself a devoted fan, if not quite a deadhead.
Well, you do spend a lot of time in the book talking about their studio output. You know, and I've always known, of course, that Working Men's Dead and American Beauty are masterpieces. But I think that to most people, they don't think of their studio output as being that important to the Grateful Dead in general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the studio output is underrated in some ways, overshadowed maybe the better word by the live performances. I do think their hearts were in the live performance. They love that relationship with the audience. There's a real energy transfer to and from the band and audience. I think Garcia really thrived in that environment. He liked the community of it. So in all those ways, I think they are properly thought of first and foremost as a performance band. But the studio albums are quite good. Not just American Beauty and Working Man's Dead, but Live Dead is terrific. It really captures the spirit of the band. And some of the later albums, while not maybe as uniformly start to finish as great as Working Man's Dead or American Beauty, they have real gems throughout. And so, yeah, there's a lot of stuff that they should be proud of in terms of the studio part of their repertoire.
You must have done quite a bit of listening to these live tapes, because you're able to tell me exactly how long the solos were and so on. And I think that's very interesting because, you know, it's kind of unbelievable that there's just a constant output monthly of live shows. How many live shows did they record, and are there still tons to come out, and how many have you listened to?
First question first. It's upwards of 2,300 shows. Those are ticketed shows. There's even more that are sort of outliers, brief appearances on television shows or benefits or whatnot. Almost all of it is recorded by one way or another, either by the band itself or by fans or both. So there's a lot. I mean, there's just a huge volume of material, and they keep going back to it. David Lemieux is their archivist and album producer these days, and he successfully, I mean, to my amazement, continues to find shows out there that have either escaped notice or the beauty of them has eluded people up to this point. And so they continue to mine that archive quite successfully. And of course, they've always tolerated this trading of tapes by fans. And so there are thousands, millions probably of tapes out there that have just been copied, you know, one friend to another. And occasionally, a warehouse or a garage will open up and someone will find a new stash of tapes, which is a ripple of excitement runs through the community. And then, of course, the online has allowed people to access those too. So now they're really quite readily available archived online. It's an incredible treasure house of material.
Is there also a treasure house of blotter acid produced by Owsley that's still potent, hiding, and?
I'm not sure I would answer that on the air, but happily I don't know the answer to that, so I can credibly say that I do not know the answer to that question.
But LSD would still be good, wouldn't it? I mean, it doesn't lose its potency.
Is that right? I actually didn't know that, but
I wouldn't know. Of course, yes, we're talking with Jim Newton, and neither he nor I would have any knowledge.
I'd like the record to show.
Yeah. I learned a lot from your book, and you're an educator, and that's really clear when reading your book. I mean, every page has interesting revelations. It's not, you know, it's a book about the Grateful Dead and about Jerry Garcia, but it's really about the era in which it all transpired. I learned, for instance, that the Beats, led by Kerouac and company, did not intend their name to suggest music beat like Beatnik or Beatles, but something else.
Yeah, too was a discovery of mine in the course of researching this book. It really meant more like beaten down, and had a much heavier, darker tonality to it at its inception than it came to when it was actually Herb Cain in San Francisco who then sort of extended beat to Beatnik, and then it became more berets and red wine, and it acquired a different kind of sensibility. It had a much more serious, weighty feel at its outset, which, like you, I learned fairly recently.
But you, in your book, you talk about the early days in San Francisco in the early, late 1950s and early 1960s. And how did San Francisco become sort of the garden in which all this fantastic music, including the Grateful Dead, bloomed?
Yeah, it's to some extent by happenstance. Other than the fact that it's a beautiful place that people are drawn to. There was a thriving poetry and art scene in San Francisco before Kerouac or Ginsberg ever came out to the West Coast. So it was really, in a sense, a melding of cultures, what they brought with them, but what was also already here. Ken Rexroth, Ferlinghetti, others were already here and practicing. And of course, it is in that environment that Garcia grew up. He attended the School for the Fine Arts here in San Francisco. I'm sorry, I'm actually here in San Francisco today. So yes. When I say here, I mean here.
We get it.
Garcia grew up in it, around the Beats, was influenced by them, considered On the Road something of a personal Bible. The Beats were here. The poetry scene was active in San Francisco. Along comes Garcia as a young person, is very much immersed in that. And then I guess the other kind of artistic, creative player that I would put into that mix is Ken Kesey and the Pranksters. Ken Kesey, who was a student at Wallace Stegner's at Stanford, and was busy writing Cuckoo's Nest there. And so when the beats sort of connect to Kesey and the Dead, then becomes the kind of house band for the Acid Test in 65 and 66. That's when all those sort of cultures swirl together. And from that comes the hippies and the next wave of San Francisco's place at the center of the counterculture.
Yes, I was pleased that in your book, I mean, there's a lot of tangents. It's a book of tangents. And one of them was about Kurt Vonnegut. What role does Kurt Vonnegut play in the story of Jerry Garcia?
Garcia was a big fan of Vonnegut. In fact, for a time owned the rights to one of Vonnegut's novels and hoped to turn it into a movie that never came to be. Vonnegut is not properly thought of as a hippie or a beat. He's really in a different tradition, but he was very much admired by Garcia and others around him. He was writing Slaughterhouse-Five, of course, is a rumination on World War II, but it came out during the Vietnam War and was very much seen as a commentary on Vietnam. So he sort of nibbles at the edges of the counterculture, but is very much admired by many of the central players in that drama, including Garcia himself.
I loved all the counterculture artifacts that show up in your book, like, for instance, the Whole Earth Catalog.
That's great. Incredible thing, isn't it? I sort of lost track of the Whole Earth Catalog, and I picked it up again. It's really quite an achievement. It's really fun.
I remember seeing it everywhere, and then at the flea market a lot. What? Tell us a little bit about that for people who don't remember. What was the Whole Earth Catalog?
Yeah, it's Steve Jobs many, many years later referred to it as the sort of progenitor of Google, and that it had it was this mishmash of it. First of all, I should note it wasn't a catalog in the way that we think of catalogs. You couldn't actually buy things from the catalog. it was really a reference manual almost. And it was intended to present interesting people with, or people who were interested in it, and in counterculture and the arts and life of the period, with tools. It was tools for reading. It had recommendations for literature. It had actual tools, things you could buy to go camping or whatever. Or you could, it would direct you to where you could buy them. But also technology, music, the arts. It was this creative, strange collection, a very large, it was done in a large format, so you would see it. I remember growing up seeing it on, you know, the coffee tables of my parents' friends' houses and things. And
next to their Grateful Dead records.
Yeah, right in the same set of the shelf. Yeah, yeah. Indeed. Yeah, it was just a great document. And it went on for a long time. It also pictured a hat on its cover initially, and some of the later editions, an actual picture of the Earth, and reinforcing that notion that we are sort of one planet, but also very much isolated and surrounded by darkness. So it had a message built into the cover that was unexplained, but easily appreciated.
You know, the 1970s, for those of us who were there, doesn't feel particularly like that long ago, or, you know, I mean, it's just as another, you know, in the course of someone's life. Oh, yeah, there was the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. And then when I read about the Whole Earth Catalog, I went, oh, my God, yeah, I haven't seen a whole. Yeah, it was a while ago, wasn't it? You know,
it does date you. Yeah. Yeah.
And I hadn't thought about some of those albums as well. I don't just mean the Grateful Dead albums, which have always been around, but some of the solo albums and brief other little in all of the Grateful Dead did things other than the Grateful Dead, didn't they?
They did. In fact, they took a break. It wasn't clear how long a break it would be or even whether they would come back from it in the mid-70s. And explored individual solo projects, some more solo than others. They were produced under the sort of ambit of what was then the Grateful Dead's recording company, Grateful Dead Records, which was also affiliated with Round Records. And so most of their work, their independent work, was done under the auspices of the Dead, and Garcia helped produce many of them, and Bob Weir's first very successful album, Ace, really is almost a Grateful Dead album, but with him at the center of it. And so there's a lot of overlap between the solo projects and the Grateful Dead itself. But yes, they each found expression for themselves outside the Dead. And of course, the surviving members of the Dead after Garcia died in 95 went on to produce a lot of their own music. Just last weekend here in Goldgate Park. So.
Yeah, and they just did the residency in Las Vegas and all that, right?
Exactly, yeah. Right, yeah.
One of the albums that I remember from that period was Sea Stones, which is definitely not like Ace. Ace is like Grateful Dead album, but with Bob Weir's name on it. But Sea Stones is something entirely different.
Very sonic, very experimental. There came Dead shows, particularly in the later years, assumed a certain kind of almost a format that included a long section of what was called space in the second set. Of experimental, just sound feedback. Sea Stones is at the core of that. There's a Phil Lesh innovation, but it was part of that kind of broader experimentation with sound rather than songs. And Sea Stones was a great example of that.
I was thinking about this when I was reading your book, Jim Newton. The book is called Here Beside the Rising Tide, Jerry Garcia, The Grateful Dead, and the American Awakening. You've written about President Eisenhower, for instance. And when you, you know, obviously you had to do a lot of research and you would read a lot of materials that were written about Eisenhower and I would imagine news accounts and so on. You could read them at the whatever speed it takes you to read something. But when you have to, like, listen to hours and hours of tapes, it must have been a much longer research process to write this book than writing a.
Not longer, but different. And my wife has had to suffer a lot of car trips with me listening to a lot of Grateful Dead music. So others had to pay a price, or get a benefit, depending on how you look at it. Very different for sure. There is a Grateful Dead archive at UC Santa Cruz, of course, that was extremely helpful to me, both in terms of clips that were maintained. The Grateful Dead had a clipping service for most of its life, which were particularly helpful to me because many of those come from underground press, newspapers, and magazines that are no longer in existence, so they're very hard to find otherwise. Also, lots of recorded interviews, so I was able to mine those. And, of course, the music, which is at the archive but also elsewhere. And so, yeah, there was a deliberateness to this. I mean, there are so many others who have listened to the music and thought about it and written about it that I did have a number of guides in that. It wasn't really just starting on day one and listening to 2,000 tapes. So I was able, thankfully, so many other people have gone before me, particularly in that part of the work, the thinking about the music and collecting the tapes and analyzing the tapes. So I piggybacked on a lot of that work for sure.
When I went to a Grateful Dead show back in the days of the Grateful Dead, there were a lot of young people, and they looked young, and they were dressed in hippie garb, and they were, you know, between 16 and 25 years old, and they were dancing around. And recently I've attended some shows by the Dark Star Orchestra, a band that replicates specific Grateful Dead shows, and I was shocked to find that in addition to people who would probably been at those Dead shows, there were also tons of people who were age 16 to 25 wearing a hippie garb with long hair and doing it. It's like, it's either a time machine or it's just something that's just continues to exist.
Stunning to me. I attended the shows in San Francisco last weekend, and same observation, right? It's really broad range of ages of people. Same with the Sphere in Vegas. I actually didn't go this year, but I went last year to the Sphere. On one level, that strikes me as very surprising. People too young ever to have heard Garcia himself perform now are so drawn to the music that he created or helped to create. On the other hand, I'm not surprised that there are young people who find something in this music that moves them. It just as it did me. Some of the feel of it is a little different now. I think the Dead & Company has a somewhat different feel than the Grateful Dead. But the music is the music. The scene is a very warm, kind place to be at a Dead show. I heard Dennis McNally, who's a great historian of the band and worked for the band for many years. I heard him talk the other night. And he was saying it's the only musical culture where the baseline value is kindness. I hadn't really thought of it quite that way, but I think he's got a point that there is something affirming about it. And not just the music, although it starts with the music, but with that surrounding culture that has always been around the Grateful Dead. And so I'm not surprised that young people, 16 to 25 today, find something in that I found and that countless other young people have found over the decades.
I wonder if you've discovered any kind of a gender divide in terms of Grateful Dead fanship, because I know gender is kind of an issue in your book.
I think this is a guess based on observations at shows. I've not done any study of this, but my guess is that it trends toward men, but certainly not exclusively. These Dead & Company shows I was at recently, many thousands of women were there. My guess is it tends to be a little more male and a little more white than the culture overall. That's probably true of rock music as a genre. And of course, the Dead are only partly a rock band, as it were. There's a lot of other influences there, but it grows from that same kind of piece of our culture. And so the fact that it's a little more male and a little more white is, I don't think, says that much about the Grateful Dead. I think it probably says more about who shows up at concerts and what that culture overall, how it demographically looks. But I think that's true of the Dead.
Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd are of the same era, and they're rock bands. It's really hard to, there's not a point in the Grateful Dead, I guess maybe very early, but they didn't really have that heavy rock sound even in their earliest incarnation. They were psychedelic, but not in the same psychedelic sense that Pink Floyd was.
Yeah. Yeah. At one point, Garcia's asked whether he considers the Grateful Dead psychedelic rock. And he says, no, that he considers it sort of traditional music that's played under the influence of psychedelics, which is probably a better description. Yeah, it's really, its core pieces are really more in bluegrass and country and jazz improvisation. It merges them in a way. Well, for one thing, I would say it merges them. It gathers influences that are principally American and puts them together into something that is very specifically American. It is as American a collection of music as you could imagine. But rock is kind of secondary to all of that. I think the real influences, certainly Garcia's influences, are in folk and bluegrass principally. And the others come from different places. Phil Lesh was really trained as a classical musician. Of them all, the only one who feels like a rock star, to use that term, is Bob Weir. And now, of course, Bob Weir is in his 80s, so it's hard to really think of him as a rock star. But
he was the cute one.
He supposedly approximated that. You know?
Yeah. He's not as cute anymore as he was.
Well, he's got a big beard now. He's got more of a kind of elder statesman feel to it than I grew up with anyway.
He looks like a Confederate War veteran now.
That's not bad, yeah. Or a warlock.
I actually was at one of those Dark Star Orchestra shows in which suddenly Bob Weir came and took his part and played.
Oh, that's great. That's
not quite as well as the fellow who was playing in his place.
Yeah. I've really enjoyed seeing Weir in this iteration of his musical life, that he's become the kind of spirit center of the Dead & Company in a way that in a kind of psychic space that Garcia really occupied for the Grateful Dead. And so I hope that's fulfilling for him. It seems like it should be. I hope it is.
Well, at one point you sort of drop a little quote of Jerry Garcia's that he didn't expect to live long. I mean, we don't get to see Jerry Garcia as an aged man because he didn't really live a very long life. And he knew that he wouldn't. Is that what you think?
Yeah, that's I was struck by that conversation. It's when a conversation with Robert Hunter, who wrote most of the lyrics, certainly most of the lyrics that Jerry sang. It was a little striking. It's certainly true. He lived to age 53, although he looked a lot older when he died. He lived a hard 53 years, particularly the last 10 or so. Yes, we never do get to see what Garcia would have done at this stage of his life. But he got to do a lot in the time he had, and he made the most of it. And so I think that you can wish for more, but also be satisfied that there was a big output there. I mean, it really is a body of work that stands up to time. Obviously, the fact that we're talking about it now and the fact that people are still 60,000 people are still showing up for these shows suggests that it's had some real durability.
And there's a new Jerry Garcia band an official release that's coming out, you know, this week or something.
It never stops.
Yeah. the music never stops.
There you go.
Well, I was also really moved by the fact that Garcia talked in your book about singing and that of all the things you can do, because he's a multi-instrumentalist, obviously, but of all the things you could do is singing. And the influence of Crosby, Stills, and Nash, I was surprised to read about that, too. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, they were close. The two bands were close, and Garcia and David Crosby in particular were close. And the Dead really resolved around 1970, around the time Working Man's Dead and American Beauty, to up that part of their game. Up to that, it had the emphasis really was on instruments and the relationship between the instruments. But they really inserted singing. I mean, obviously they had been singing before that, but singing as something to be mindful of and to really concentrate on, starting with those albums. And he and Weir both seem to very much have enjoyed it. You know, sometimes you listen to some of these tapes and they don't sound great. And sometimes there were difficulties in live performance and hearing each other. And so harmonies are very difficult if you're not able to hear the others. Donna Jean Gaucho, the only woman ever to play on continuing basis with the band, would sometimes sound sort of off key, I think, to many people in the audience. But a lot of that is just the difficulties of amplification and of being able to listen to and hear each other. It's easier with the instruments than it is with voices. So sometimes I think people don't give them credit as singers. But the albums really do showcase them as talented singers and as people who care, as musicians who really cared about that aspect of their work in a way that the first couple albums didn't really do justice to.
Another reason to look at their studio output.
Yeah, again, exactly. In fact, you can find now, of course, there's a tape of everything, right? But there you can actually find the vocal tracks that have been isolated and listen to them working on their harmonies and singing them. And again, it reinforces how important that part of the work was to them.
It's interesting. And this grew out of talking with or being with Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
Yes. Getting to know them, listening to their work, appreciating the harmonies and their work, and seeing the potential that it had for moving listeners and for conveying the music. And so I think their association, you know, there was a, people sometimes talk about the San Francisco sound from the 60s and 70s.
Right.
That's a little misleading because these bands had very different sounds, but there was clearly a San Francisco scene in which they were enjoying each other and learning from each other, and that's one of the byproducts of that.
Oh, yeah. One of the things I learned, Professor Newton, in your book, was the degree that Jerry Garcia contributed to Surrealistic Pillow, the best of all the Jefferson Airplane albums, I would think.
Yeah, and largely uncredited. I think he's credited as a spiritual advisor or something. He was under contract, of course, with a different label, so he couldn't really officially participate in it. But he was worked as a kind of de facto engineer on the album and really learned a lot while also contributing to them, learned a lot about producing albums that he then brought to the Grateful Dead. But that the overlap between those bands Jefferson Airplane, Janis Joplin, Big Brother and the Holding Company, later Santana. Those bands all, again, they didn't replicate each other's sounds, but they definitely learned from each other and contributed to each other's work in ways that made all of them better.
You mentioned Jerry Garcia's pedal steel guitar on Teach Your Children, which is so iconic part of the song. You can't really separate that song from that.
It's the line that everyone knows, right? Is that very subtle, very beautiful pedal steel through there, and that's Garcia, yeah.
And most people who play pedal steel, you know, like Sneaky Pete Kleinow or whoever, they spent their whole lives mastering the pedal steel.
Yeah, he did it in a relatively short time. He was just a voracious consumer of musical styles. And of course, put it to use with Olden and the Way. You know, Olden and the Way is this kind of throw off album, really, by Garcia and Dave Grisman and several other musicians. That they, you know, they got together to try to play some music and enjoyed it and played some shows together. And then that just happens to be a recording from one of those sessions. But it is from one of those shows, rather. It's a testament to his real facility with music that he could pick up a very notoriously difficult instrument to play. And yeah, I'm sure there are others who play it better than he does, but he certainly mastered it to a degree that he was a more than credible or capable pedal steel player from that point on.
Well, you mentioned the sort of warmth of the feeling of the Grateful Dead, but yet there's sort of something about Garcia that is both warm and inviting and also repellent. That is, when you talk about Olden and the Way, and you mentioned that David Grisman did not profit from Olden and the Way, even though the album sold a zillion copies and is still out there, and that Garcia was completely either unaware or uninterested in David Grisman's plight.
Yes, Garcia could be kind of willfully ignorant. He just hated to lead. He hated to be seen as the financial or even the musical center of the Grateful Dead. He was, and so that created a kind of awkward problem because everyone looked to him to be that leader. And And in many ways, he did accept leadership. So when there were questions about whether this song or that song was a Grateful Dead song, it was really Jerry Garcia who made that decision or whose approval was necessary for that to go forward. So in that sense, he was the de facto leader, but he hated to get involved with disputes or conflicts. He hated to deal with money. And for most of their lives, the Grateful Dead were really not wealthy at all for two thirds of their tenure. And then suddenly they became very, very wealthy almost overnight. There were consequences for that. And one, as you point out, was that Olden and the Way turned out to be this smash success. It was for many years the biggest selling bluegrass album in history. But the players on it just got the money that they'd received for their performance and I think $1,000 or $2,500 bonus when they released the album. And so for David Grisman, it was a source of a lot of unhappiness to watch the Grateful Dead go off and play venues with 60, 70, 80,000 people while he was back home driving a beat up car, wishing he could reap some of that. Ultimately, they patched it up. And in fact, Garcia's final years, one of his happiest things was playing duets with David Grisman. So they did work through it. But for many years, it was a source of bitterness on Grisman's behalf. And I think now much way in the past, but at the time, something that Garcia could have involved himself in and either was unaware or just unwilling to get his hands dirty on it.
And that extended to his children. You say that his wife, I think they're married, right? Mountain Girl, were they married or not married? Married.
Well, they were not married when they had their daughters, but they later married, yes.
And she moved away to wherever she moved and was looking for child support and got none.
Yeah. You know, Garcia's family members have been very generous to me and I'm indebted to them for their insights into him. And yet, I think it is safe to say that his genius was as a musician, not as a parent, not as a husband. He didn't have much in the way of role modeling there. I'm not saying this to excuse it. His own father died when he was just a little boy. In fact, his father drowned on a trip they were on together, a fishing trip. So he grew up without a lot to model himself on. But one thing I think that's sort of sort of paradoxical here is that he so was at the center of this family structured community, right? The Grateful Dead family is a phrase you hear all the time. And loved that, didn't want to perform as a solo artist, didn't want to go off and compose on his own. He loved being with people. But that did not extend to any capacity as a husband or as a father. I do think he loved his daughters. I think he loved his wives. But he was inattentive to them and really just did not know how to handle those responsibilities well. He was not a great bearer of responsibility.
Well, you alluded there to his youth and his role models. He had a difficult relationship with his mother. In fact, let me ask you this. His name is Garcia. From where does the name Garcia come? We normally associate that with a Latino, but it's not in his case.
Not in this case. It's Spanish. Uh-huh. His father was a musician who came from Spain, settled in San Francisco, met and married his mother in San Francisco. Eventually ran afoul of the Musicians Union in San Francisco. And so in Garcia's youth growing up, his father and mother were really their income came from a bar called Garcia's, Joe Garcia's in the city. But yeah, his father then Garcia back to back tragedies really in his youth. First, he lost the better part of his middle finger when his brother accidentally cut it off with an axe when they were playing a game in the Santa Cruz Mountains when they were kids. And then very shortly thereafter, he and his mother and father went on a fishing trip and his father went out to fish and drowned. And at that point, it overwhelmed his mother, who then left him in the care of his grandparents. So it was a disjointed childhood. It was one difficulty after another. His mother ultimately remarried and took them back in, but he never really settled back into that family. And he was a pretty rowdy, wayward kid up until the point that he joined the army. and I guess I probably don't need to tell you or your listeners that he was not well cut out to be a soldier. So he did not last long in the Army. And then when he left the Army, that's when he came to Palo Alto and really his musical career began to take shape at that point.
Losing a finger, I would think, for someone who's a musician would be very difficult.
It's pre-Jerry Garcia musician, but it is interesting that he went on to a career in music knowing that he was going to have to do it with nine fingers, not 10. It doesn't seem to have slowed him down much, but yes, he lost a finger at a very young age.
That's very, and of course, now it's kind of an iconic image of this hand without his finger on it.
I was at Oracle Park just last night, and they were selling those foam hands that have fingers on it, and they were selling Garcia ones with a middle finger. No, it's a universally recognized symbol among deadheads now, but I was a little surprised to see it at the baseball stadium.
That's funny. Tell me a little bit about Robert Hunter, who was his main collaborator as a songwriter. I mean, are they Rodgers and Hammerstein, Lennon and McCartney, somewhere?
Yeah, well, right up there, I would say. I mean, Robert Hunter is just a brilliant lyricist, wrote for other artists. He actually wrote a little bit for Bob Dylan, and he wrote a little bit for songs that Bob Weir performed as well. But really, the principal relationship was with Garcia. They met in those Palo Alto days when they were both very poor and living out of their cars, initially performed together. Hunter was a very credible musician, guitar player, but not at the level that Garcia was. And so soon, I think fairly early in their relationship, they recognized that his great genius was with words, whereas Garcia's was as a performer. And once they figured that out, that was the beginning of this extremely productive and creative output that the two of them put together. In the very first years of the Dead, there's one song that Jerry Garcia is credited on as the lyricist, and I think it's safe to say that he was lucky to find Robert Hunter, because that was not his gift, but it clearly was Hunter's, and so they were a wonderful friendship and a wonderful songwriting team.
Yeah. So in your work on this book, Jim Newton, who did you talk to?
Lots of people, both from the sort of inner circle around Garcia and also more broadly from the counterculture. So, Al Franken, Jane Fonda, Tom Hayden was an old friend. And so although Tom died before I was working on the book, I talked to him many times about the counterculture. Jerry Brown, Dianne Feinstein. A whole group of people to talk about the sort of the politics and culture of the period. And then a different group of people, sometimes overlapping, who were close to Garcia. Jerry Garcia's first wife, Sarah Ruppenthal Katz, was extremely helpful to me. His daughter, Trixie, Mountain Girl, to whom he was married for many years. A combination of people close and people as part of the cultural conversation. And then I guess the other thing I should add is, Garcia himself, although I never met him or interviewed him, much less interviewed him, memorialized at the Grateful Dead Archive are dozens, hundreds, I'm tempted to say, interviews with him and other members of the band. So I was able to use archival material to get his voice into the book. And he's a great interview. Another happy discovery on my part. He's contradictory. Sometimes he'll say one thing and sometimes he'll say another. But there's no sense of kind of calculation about him in his interviews. He's not a strategist. He's not trying to sell a record. There's no messaging. He's really fun to listen to. Very smart, very well read, and very loose in an interview. As I say, sometimes he could kind of talk himself in circles. Those ended up being a real resource too. So not only my own interviews, but the interviews that are archived there all went into the book.
Jerry Garcia was a pretty well educated guy and literate. And yet I noticed in a lot of the quotes that he uses poor grammar. I wonder if that's something that he affected.
First of all, he's very smart and well-read. He wasn't really well-educated in the sense that he dropped out of high school and went to the Army. But I think his kind of looseness with language is more the way a singer talks, right? The sound of his voice comes through in interviews, and sometimes more almost than the specific words. He's got a kind of bouncy spirit that runs through a lot of his interviews, and I think he can be casual with language sometimes when he's sort of hearing himself talk. But you're right, his grammar's hit or miss, I would say.
We're talking with Jim Newton, and his new book is called Here Beside the Rising Tide, Jerry Garcia, the Grateful Dead, and the American Awakening. And I want to know about the American Awakening. What is awakening? What woke up during the years of the Grateful Dead?
I appreciate that. I think it's a coming to realization first of all, let me just say the counterculture is a very disparate thing, right? It's very hard to describe as one entity, and sometimes the counterculture does a bit of an injustice because there's all these threads that run through it, and I try to at least illustrate them through the book. They do have some things in common, and one, I think, was an abiding sense that the government didn't speak for them, that mainstream culture, and most specifically the government, didn't represent a certain kind of thinking or way of living. And that expresses itself in a lot of different spheres, whether it's in racial civil rights, whether it's in the rise of women's rights, whether it's in gay rights a little bit later, in the relation to the environment and the treatment of the earth, and most specifically and most powerfully with respect to the Vietnam War, of course. In all those ways, the government and society at large was expressing a certain way of approaching those problems. The technocracy is how Theodore Roszak described it, that felt alienating to a certain segment of the population. And that segment started relatively small and in a few pockets in California and New York and elsewhere, and got bigger and bigger. And expressed itself in all kinds of ways, some in very mainstream ways, running candidates to oppose those who supported the war, for instance. Robert Kennedy, would be a preeminent example of that. But then there is a different thread that's less within the confines of the culture, and that's a protest, a peaceful protest that in many cases, as time went on, became more and more violent. All kinds of expressions in the arts, whether that's in movies or literature or, of course, in music. And so it's trying to – what I was hoping to do, or I'm hoping to do in this book, is to portray in broad strokes what that looked like and what that felt like. And I guess I can go on and on about this, but I'll just close with it's also important to think that it's a counterculture. It is running counter to something, right? And that something was a society and a government that seemed indifferent to the fate of the earth, that seemed willing to sacrifice the lives of Americans and Vietnamese for purposes that were hard to articulate or understand, that seemed willing to elevate some people over others. Those things many people found offensive, and they lived their lives counter to those ideas. And so if the counterculture means anything, I think it means something like that.
Well, it makes me wonder why there are not millions of people in the street today. That is, so many of the situations that you just described are in place in our current administration. And why do you think that there's not a similar rising up of counterculture today?
I think there is some. I just a few weeks ago was out there with folks in my town in Pasadena as folks were registering their, this No Kings Day that attracted national attention, and millions of people turned out. I do think, and this is really from my political writer part of my portfolio, but what I would say is that I think there was a little bit of unsteadiness and bewilderment about Trump too, and how quickly it moved. It certainly seemed to catch the Democratic establishment kind of flat-footed. And so I think there's a kind of grasping for direction and uncertainty about how dire this is. Now, keep in mind, it took the counterculture, the counterculture of the 60s and 70s, a long time to find its way forward, too. It wasn't an organized plan that rolled out. I mean, there are many benchmark moments to look back at and see them as consequential in retrospect, but some of them were hard to appreciate in the moment. And it took a long time for the Vietnam War to end. So I wouldn't find fault with those right now who are struggling to find a response to what the Trump administration is doing. But the urgency of it is profound. The closest I've seen to what I would describe as a kind of full-throated counterculture response where I am in Los Angeles normally has been in response to these ICE raids, that there is something so disruptive and aggressive about these masked, military garbed, real sort of almost soldiers running through communities and snatching up people at Home Depots that that's alarming and has generated a genuine backlash. Now, where that goes or whether that causes a change in policy, time will tell. But I do think it felt to me like that was an organic and sincere community response to a threat from the government that is unlike or an order of magnitude more significant than what had come before.
Well, that makes me think that maybe it was because there was a war in Vietnam in which young people were dying, mm-hmm. and therefore they felt more that their lives were at stake, that led to a more robust protest movement than there is today.
There's no question about it. And I think the end of the draft and the end of the Vietnam War both significantly dampened the energy of the counterculture. But there are worse things than winning, you know, and in a certain sense, I mean, the counterculture did prevail in that. And so if the cost was a loss of energy of the counterculture, well, that's a small price to pay for ending the Vietnam War. But I do think that, you know, there right now it is a country with lots and lots of interests and lots of groups that are some are offended by one aspect of the Trump presidency and some others. They haven't always found each other. That may happen. I think there is substantial opposition. I mean, the other thing to remember is that the counterculture, had several foes, but one of them maybe most obviously was Nixon. Nixon won a landslide victory in 1972. He won more than 60% of popular votes. Donald Trump has never carried a majority of votes cast in an election. So while the Trump phenomenon is disorienting, it also does not have nearly the public support for it that Nixon and that wave did. So it may also be more vulnerable while being disorienting at the same time.
But it moves at such a the speed with which things happen is so much faster than it was in the 1960s. And I'm wondering if Nixon was not involved so much in that gerrymandering thing that the Republicans are at work doing. He didn't have the courts behind him in the way. I know you're an expert in the courts as well. What do you make of that current situation?
Nixon probably didn't need to gerrymander because he had a more genuine base of support, much broader base of support than Trump does. The court is a source of endless disappointment for me, anyway, as someone who's written about it. There are a couple of justices who I never had much confidence in, but there are a couple others who I, including the Chief Justice, who seem to me more intelligent than their work. And some of the court's reasoning in Dobbs, for instance, the abortion case, is just so sloppy that not only, I think, does it lack, not only is it acting not acting as a counterweight to the president, it's not acting as a very thoughtful institution in its own right. And so obviously that's beyond the scope of this book, but it is, it has removed from the architecture of our system, an institution that ought to be able to be there and defend the constitutional values that are supposed to be the cohering agent of our society. And I feel like this court whether it's under immunity or abortion or any number of other topics, has found expedient ways through, not principled ways through, and that is doing its own set of damage.
Yes. So, is there any hope that you see? How do you see things turning out?
That's a big one. Is there hope? Of course, there's hope. History's long, and it doesn't. It's not fair to freeze it at any moment and think that this is the moment that matters. It all matters. I think it's a resilient country. I mean, every time one of my students says, we've never been more divided, I'll say, well, there was a civil war. It has been worse. And that is not a way, that's not a suggestion that we should be sanguine about the present, but it is a reminder that the country is, a young country compared to many. It's still got a lot of history and a lot of resilience. And I do think, and in this case, I am heartened by the fact that most people in this country do not seem to support the policies of this government. Lots of people support one policy or another, but taken overall, I mean, majorities of Americans don't like Donald Trump's economic policy. When majorities of Americans don't like the immigration policy. He may be impervious to that in the moment, but over time that makes a difference. And I do think the country will be here tomorrow. I'm pretty confident and hopeful. I do think there's a path forward. It's just sometimes it's hard to see it.
Well, you said that this part of our conversation was outside the scope of your book, but I would say that that's not true, because there's nothing that is outside the scope of this book. Here Beside the Rising Tide, Jerry Garcia, The Grateful Dead, and An American Awakening. I think it's an amazing work, and I congratulate you, and I thank you for writing it and for spending some time talking to me about it here on From the Bookshelf.
I very much appreciate that, and enjoy having the chance to talk to you about it. So thank you for that, too.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, "Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf." And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.